Didn't think so. Are you a buyer? Before Nate could come up with a good answer, a door opened and the man he'd seen earlier, presumably Joshua, strode in. Joshua looked from his father to Nate and back to his father again.
What's going on? He asked.
We're talking fish, Nate said.
Fish? Joshua said with a smirk. Just fish?
Joshua was thin and gaunt, with sharp, hawk-like features and unkind, narrow eyes. Even from across the room, and despite the pungent fish food, Nate could smell the reek of marijuana from his clothing.
"Looking for something to help you get through the winter?" Joshua asked Nate. "I figure that's why you're here."
Nate nodded his head slightly. Now he got it. The reason for Jack's strange reticence and Joshua's behavior when he saw him on the road.
I want to see what I'm buying first,
Nate said.
Before you go out there, Jack said,
indicating to Nate the door Joshua had used,
I've got to ask you something. Are you law enforcement?
Nate turned back to him.
No.
Are you affiliated with any state or federal agency?
No.
Prove it.
In his peripheral vision, Joshua moved so that an unused concrete fish tank was between them. What was in the tank? A gun?
How do I prove it?
Nate asked. He'd never been mistaken for a cop before, and he thought Jack probably surmised that.
I'm going to pat you down, Jack said.
No, you're not.
Nate unzipped his coat and opened it so Jack could see the butt of his .454 Casull.
Jack, if you put your hands on me, this will turn out to be a really bad day for you.
He turned his head toward Joshua.
You too.
Rather than reach inside the tank or get angry, Joshua grinned.
I don't think we need to worry about him, Dad. I've been expecting him.
Jack nodded his agreement. Nate thought,
You have?
Follow me, Joshua said. He gets paranoid easy,
Joshua said to Nate as they crossed the yard toward the nearest long metal building. He don't trust nobody.
I don't blame him,
Nate said. He noted that the right side of Joshua's heavy Carhartt parka sagged more than the left. Gun in there, Nate thought.
He mentioned a raceway,
Nate said.
That's what we call where we raise the mature fish, you'll see.
Nate followed Joshua through a metal doorway into the building. It was one long area with six separate lanes where water coursed through. Trout were stacked in each lane with their noses aimed at the inflow. Some rose and kissed the surface with their dorsal fins. It was colder in the raceway building, and the fish smell was much stronger than in the incubator room.
I was starting to think you wouldn't show up,
Joshua said as he dug a stubby pipe and a baggie of marijuana from his pocket. He lit the pipe, inhaled deeply, then handed it to Nate. Nate wiped off the mouthpiece and took a deep drag. It was a test, he knew, to ensure he wasn't a cop. Joshua obviously thought he was someone else, though. Nate decided to play along. He could feel it immediately.
Good shit, isn't it? Joshua said.
Nate agreed.
I used to grow it, but the market dried up. Fish shit is great fertilizer. Well, when Colorado legalized weed just across the border, my customers went south.
Nate nodded to the raceways and slowly expelled the smoke from his lungs.
I would have thought it would freeze in the winter,
Nate said.
Nah, the water from the spring stays at 45 degrees summer and winter. It's the perfect temp to keep them healthy and feeding. Lower than that, they don't grow fast enough. Hotter than that, they get sluggish.
So why cover it?
Nate asked, indicating the roof.
To keep out the critters that like to eat fish, Joshua said. Mink, raccoons, blue herons, osprey, people.
People?
You'd be surprised how many idiots have come out here with their fishing poles. We lock the buildings at night so they can't get in, but they still try.
Nate followed Joshua on a metal-grated walkway that spanned all six of the raceways. He half-listened as Joshua explained that males were confined to one lane and females to the other, except for spawning season, and that brown and rainbow trout matured at 2 to 3 years. One lane was filled with massive 2-foot-long trout used strictly as broodstock. The grate led to a steel door at the end of the building.
"Now you see where the magic happens," Joshua said. "Now you see how we get through the winter."
Nate stayed behind Joshua's shoulder while he dug a key out of his pocket and unlocked the door. Before opening it, he grinned. What if Kate was kept inside? Not likely, but... The smell from inside was a mix of paint thinner and ammonia, and it was so strong it made Nate's eyes tear up. And they entered the Tubner Meth Lab. The room was made of concrete, and it had no windows. 55-gallon drums sat in the middle of it, and a bench was filled with Pyrex containers, mason jars, and rolls of hoses. A tall anhydrous ammonia gas cylinder with a blue-colored brass valve stood near the drums, and in the corner of the room was a loose bundle of red-stained bedsheets that were used for straining. The odor was nearly overpowering, and as if in response, Joshua hit a switch that turned on a fan to vent it outside. Nate stepped back through the open door until the air in the room cleared.
"What we got here," Joshua said, "is a fucking perfect setup for making high-quality crystal. I get the pseudoephedrine through my old man's industrial chemical accounts because he buys a lot of different stuff to keep this place disinfected. The fish smell disguises the meth cooking, so as long as I keep the door closed, even the smartest cop or fish inspector wouldn't notice it."
He refilled his pipe and lit it again.
"I've doubled my product in the past year, and I could do it again. You'll never have to worry about supply," he said.
"So you've got a lot of customers around here?"
Nate asked.
"Oh, yeah," Joshua said with a wide grin. "I go along when Pop delivers fish and sell hits to the ranch hands and shit. You'd be amazed how many crystal cowboys there are around here." "But let's talk business," Joshua said. "Let's talk territory."
"Okay."
"I'm thinking I want you distributing in the northern half of the state, from Casper up, but I get Casper. Casper's a fucking gold mine with all those unemployed energy workers. I keep the south. That means you get Jackson Hole, Sheridan, Gillette, Cody. That ought to keep you busy and make you rich. Gillette's a gold mine, too, but you have to compete with asshats from Rapid City and Sturgis. But my product is better, though. You'll do fine," Joshua said.
"And make you even richer,"
Nate said.
"That's how it's supposed to work," Joshua said with a stoner smile. He said, "You can charge $50 or more for a quarter gram because this is really good meth. You set the price. I don't want anything to do with your business. But don't set it too high and scare off customers. If I was you, I'd start low and build up your clientele, then gradually increase the price. That's what I did down here, and it worked out just fine for me."
"How much?"
Nate asked. Joshua looked at Nate with a hint of suspicion.
"I thought we talked about that. I'll sell you each quarter gram for $25. $100 for a gram, and you'll clear $100 for your pocket."
"Or," Joshua said, waggling his eyebrows, "you can get that half kilo we talked about for $50,000. Did you bring the money with you?"
"In my Yukon,"
Nate said. He hoped the person Joshua had been expecting wouldn't show up while they were talking in the lab.
"Cool, cool," Joshua said. "You want to sample the product?"
Nate's head was still clouded from the single inhalation of Joshua's marijuana, and he shook his head no. Nate wasn't used to how strong weed was these days.
I trust you.
You should. This is high-quality shit. So go get the money, and I'll measure out that half kilo. You can watch if you want, so you know you're getting what you paid for.
Nate didn't want to be rushed into revealing himself, so he asked,
So you go on fish runs with your dad and sell on the side. That gives you cover.
Joshua nodded.
Do you have customers at the Silver Creek Ranch?
I've got a few customers there, sure.
He'd answered quickly, impatiently. Joshua wanted to see the money.
Do you recall a British woman last summer? Blonde?
Joshua narrowed his eyes.
Are you talking about Kate?
Nate felt a jolt go up his back.
What about her?
Joshua asked with suspicion.
Did you sell to her?
Who the fuck are you? Joshua asked, suddenly alarmed. Why would you care about her?
He reached into his coat and pointed a 9mm Charter Arms semi-auto at Nate's nose. It was a cheap handgun, a favorite of drug dealers, and Nate had no respect for people who carried one. Joshua held the weapon sideways like gangbangers did in the movies. That also irritated Nate. But he cursed himself because he'd let it happen. His head had been too clouded to react.
You need to put that away,
Nate said.
I asked who the fuck you were,
Joshua said, spittle forming on his lips.
You're not Hargrove.
My name is Nate. Hargrove sent me in his place.
Joshua processed that, and as he did, his face screwed up quizzically, but the muzzle of the gun stayed up.
I'm going to call him and check that out,
Joshua said, nodding his head and finally deciding on a plan.
He didn't say nothing about sending another guy. But you need to get rid of your piece.
Okay,
Nate said.
Don't try nothing.
I won't.
Nate pulled his coat aside with his left hand and slowly reached for the grip of his revolver with his right. Joshua's eyes followed Nate's right hand. Those eyes didn't track that Nate had leaned his upper body a few inches to the side, so that if Joshua's weapon went off, the bullet would miss his head and slam into the concrete wall behind him. In one lightning motion, Nate drew the .454, cocked it while he raised it, and shot Joshua in the right shoulder. The concussion was thunderous in the closed room, and Joshua's body spun 180 degrees from the impact. The 9mm clattered on the floor. Nate closed the distance between them with two long steps and grabbed Joshua by the back collar of his coat and dragged him out through the meth lab door. The exit wound had spattered the wall with blood, and the slug had penetrated the concrete, leaving a neat O in the wall. Joshua cried out for help, and he didn't stop screaming until Nate plunged into the raceway used for broodstock and pulled him in after him. In the cold, waist-high water, Nate holstered his gun and plunged Joshua's face into the water as most of the big trout in the lane fled for the inlet end in a rush that made a froth on the top of the surface. After holding him down long enough that Joshua began to panic and thrash his legs, Nate pulled him back up. A ribbon of red from his shoulder wound streaked the lane and curled toward the outflow grate.
I told you to put that gun away,
Nate hissed.
Joshua gasped for air and said, You shot my arm off.
Not completely,
Nate said,
but I'll rip it out of the socket if you don't tell me what you know about Kate.
I don't know anything,
Joshua yelled.
You knew her name.
Joshua's eyes pleaded with Nate.
I knew her name and that's all. I saw her out there and thought I'd really like to hit that, you know? But I didn't do nothing. I never made a move on her.
Was she a customer?
No!
Do you know what happened to her?
When Joshua hesitated too long, Nate dunked his head under the water again and held it there until the man kicked at the surface of the water in a panic. Then he pulled him back up. As he did, a ball of broodstock trout that had retreated to the outlet end of the lane decided as one to muscle past Nate to join the others on the far end where they'd pooled together. As the brown trout went by, Nate reached down and grasped one just in front of its powerful tail. It was about 4 pounds.
"I asked if you knew what happened to her," Nate said, while swinging the trout.
He smacked Joshua in the side of his head with a wet slap.
"I heard at a bar that she's still around," Joshua gasped.
"Who told you that?"
"I overheard it at the Rustic from a couple of old guys. I don't know them. I really don't. I was texting a buddy of mine at the time, making a deal. I kept my head down."
"What did they look like?"
"Old, I told you, like my dad."
"Who do they work for?"
"I don't know. Shit!"
Nate smacked him with the trout hard enough that the fish spasmed and died after the blow.
"Stop hitting me with that fish," Joshua said. "I was out of it at the time."
"When was this?"
"Last fall, October, November, I don't know."
"Think. What can you tell me about them?"
"That's all I can remember," Joshua pleaded. "I thought I heard him say they saw her and she was hiding out, but I ain't even sure that I didn't imagine it. Like I said, I was testing out my own product at the time."
Nate studied Joshua's face, which was twisted from pain. Then he let him go. Joshua dropped into the raceway and scrambled back to his feet while sputtering. He'd swallowed a lot of water. His right arm hung straight down, and he pinned it to his body with his left hand.
"It's a through-and-through meat wound," Nate said to Joshua. "You'll recover if you don't bleed out. Go get your dad to clean it out and bind it up."
"It hurts really bad,"
Joshua said in a little boy voice.
"It's supposed to,"
Nate said. In his Yukon on the way back toward Saratoga, Nate watched his cell phone until it finally found a signal. Joe had called but not left a message. Probably checking on him, Nate thought. As the Tubner fish hatchery receded in his rear-view mirror, he saw a jacked-up 4x4 with Campbell County license plates coming through the snowdrifts Nate had bucked to get there. Nate pulled over to let the vehicle pass by and saw it was driven by a nervous-looking skinny guy with a pointed nose and a wisp of beard.
"Sorry, Hargrove,"
Nate said as the car went by. The large brown trout lay on the passenger side floor mat. It was a beautiful fish, and Nate felt guilty for braining it. Joe liked a fish dinner, and maybe he'd approve. He wouldn't approve of Nate's interrogation methods, however. Chapter 17. Joe found Sheridan riding long figure eights on a sorrel gelding on the loose sand surface of the indoor arena. Although the arena was heated with forced air furnaces the size of pickup trucks in each corner, it was cold enough outside, and the arena was so massive that the gelding puffed clouds of condensation as it loped. Sheridan looked good in the saddle, Joe thought. Better than he ever had. Her movements were fluid, and she guided the horse by leg pressure rather than tugging on its bit with the reins. She saw him come through the door, and she tipped her hat as she rode. He waved back. There were 5 horses and a stall on the far wall. 3 had the sweaty imprint of a saddle still on their backs. After completing the pattern, Sheridan rode up to Joe and pulled the gelding to a sliding stop. "Now you're just showing off," Joe said with a proud grin.
"Gotta keep 'em all tuned up so they remember their horses," she said. "I've got one more to go today, and then I'll dry them off and turn them out."
"Don't let me rush you," Joe said.
"Have you had lunch?"
"Nope."
"How about a late afternoon snack? Soup okay?"
"Yep." Your mom would love to do your job. So would April. Sheridan grinned. Her face was flushed red from the exertion of saddling and riding four horses, one right after the other.
I think about that. I kind of feel bad about it sometimes.
With that, she clicked her tongue, and the gelding spun away. Sheridan's apartment was located on the second floor above the arena itself. There was a small kitchen, a bathroom, a fabric couch and matching chair, a desk with her laptop, and a wall filled with family photos that tugged at his heart. The room was neater than Joe would have guessed it would be, judging by the state of her room when she lived at home. The apartment overlooked the empty arena on one side and the vast white winter landscape on the other. Outside, with the sun reflecting off the snow, it was so bright it hurt his eyes. He sat at a small table while she emptied condensed tomato soup into a pot and added water. She'd hung up her jacket on a rack near the door and kicked off her cowboy boots.
"Grilled cheese?" she asked.
"That would be great," he said. Joe excused himself to use the bathroom while she prepared the food. He couldn't recall her ever having done that for him before. Sure, his oldest daughter had helped Mary Beth with some meals, usually during holidays, but it used to be that Joe was often the cook when his girls were growing up, especially breakfast. He could tell she was thinking similar thoughts about the role reversal as well. In the bathroom, he glanced at the shower, generic and exotic hair products, a loofah, and looked hard at the mirrored medicine cabinet, but decided not to open it. He didn't want to find any men's items, and thought it best not to look, even though he guessed Mary Beth would have, if given the same opportunity. "Thank you," he said, as he spooned the last of his soup. "It was delicious." She looked at him to check out his sincerity.
"It came out of a can."
"Still, it was good." She gathered up the dishes and told him that her apartment was one of the few reserved for senior staff, and she was lucky she didn't have to share it with anyone. Most of the employees spent the summer season in dorm-like buildings located about a quarter mile away and had to bunk together.
"This is a good place," she said, sitting back down. "I never thought I'd want to work at a guest ranch."
"How much of it is because of Lance Ramsey?" he asked.
"Dad," she said, blushing. "So tell me about Kate," he said, changing the subject for the benefit of both of them. Sheridan said, "Well, some guests really like to stand out while they're here. It's strange. You've got these rich and famous people trying to impress all of us nobodies. But Kate wasn't like that. She blended in and just seemed to enjoy herself. I'd say she was a perfect guest."
Joe nodded for her to go on. "She was hungover most mornings," Sheridan said with a knowing smile. "She was English, after all, so it's not unusual. But there's no doubt writing was her thing. It was her passion. We're encouraged to accommodate the guests as much as we can. So if we have one who wants to ride outside of the scheduled rides, we do our best to make that happen. By the end of the week, she wanted to go on early morning rides and evening rides after the rest of the guests had turned their horses in."
"Did she go alone?"
Joe asked. "We can't allow that," Sheridan said. "That's against policy, and it should be for the safety of our guests."
"So you accompanied her?"
"A couple of times, yes, but she mainly went out with Lance. It's kind of a big deal for a guest to ride with a head wrangler, and she really liked that."
"When you were with her, did she talk to you about anything?"
"Mostly horses and scenery," Sheridan said. "She said she tried fly fishing and shooting, but that wasn't her thing. Really, what we talked about was her, even though she asked me about my background once. She was really interested to hear how I grew up and that I wasn't as crazy about horses as my mom and my sister were. She really didn't get the concept of you being a game warden, I don't think, but we didn't talk about me much.
Did you find that odd?
Not at all, Sheridan said. It's part of the training here. We have to keep in mind that this isn't about us. That's hard for some of the staff because they're naturally so self-centered.
A lot of kids my age have grown up being told they were the center of the universe. I get that. But if they don't learn to put that aside for the sake of the guests, they don't last long around here.
I approve, Joe said.
Sheridan laughed and said, I thought you would.
What kinds of things did she tell you when you rode together?
Stuff I've heard before, but she was really intense about it. She talked a lot about the contrast between the ranch and her life at home. It weirded her out at first not to be connected all the time. She said the first time she turned off her iPhone and left it back in her room, she nearly had an anxiety attack, that kind of thing. I got the impression that her life back in England was really high pressure, and that just getting from place to place was a major hassle. Kate loved the natural beauty of the ranch, and she said the slower pace made her crazy at first until she got used to it. She said it took a lot of getting used to just to enjoy herself and soak it all in, to realize that people around her weren't going to demand anything of her.
Joe noted that.
Kate did once say that she'd never felt more free in her life, Sheridan said. She told me I didn't know how lucky I was to live with such freedom. Of course, she didn't have any idea how many hours we work while the guests are relaxing. I know that the last couple of days she was here, she said she really didn't want to go back. Kate seemed to love this place even more than most guests, and you could see a troubled look cross her face when she talked about going home.
Interesting, he said. Any idea what troubled her?
Not really. A lot of guests say that. In fact, most of them. This is kind of a fantasy camp for some people, and they don't want to go back to their real world once they get used to it.
Joe asked, Did she talk about any of the staff or any of the guests while you were with her? Did anyone interest her or annoy her?
Not that I can remember, Sheridan said. Then paused. She did mention that she didn't like the way the Youngbergs looked at her when they were shoeing the horses, but she sort of rolled her eyes when she said it like it was no big deal. I think I told her those two yahoos look at every female that way.
As we know, Joe said.
Sheridan rolled her eyes in agreement.
That would have been really something if you and Lance fought them last night.
Luckily, we didn't. But I was impressed how Lance stood up for you.
So was I, Sheridan said, with a wistful smile that told Joe more than she probably wanted to.
By the way, where is Lance? I wanted to ask him some of the same questions.
He'll be here by Monday, she said. He's got the weekend off, and he went up to his cabin. He usually comes back Sunday afternoon.
Is it here on the ranch?
No, it's about 20 miles away, up in the snowy range. It's been in his family for years, and he really likes to go up there whenever he can. We can drive there in the early summer, but in the winter it's really hard to get to, and he has to snowmobile in.
Joe noted the we, and Sheridan realized at the same time what she'd revealed.
Oops, she said.
He seems like a good guy, Joe said. I hope he knows better than to do my daughter wrong.
Sheridan flushed and shook her head.
The things you say.
So what do you think happened to her? Joe asked. You must have thought about it and talked about it with other people here.
There were a million theories, as you can guess, she said. You've probably heard most of them already. That she got kidnapped on the highway, that somebody on the staff here grabbed her, that a ranch contractor targeted her and took her after her stay.
I've heard all those, Joe said. What do you think?
Sheridan sat back. You really want my opinion?
He nodded. Next to your mother, you're the smartest person I know. Plus, you've got a unique perspective on the whole case.
I think it was something else, Sheridan said thoughtfully. I just don't know what.
Why do you say that? He asked.
But he'd felt the hairs rise on the back of his neck, because he thought the same thing. Because in each of those scenarios, her car isn't accounted for, she said. Kate drove a 2017 silver Jeep Cherokee with Colorado rental plates. It couldn't have just vanished from the face of the earth. Somebody around here would have seen it if any of those three things happened.
He said, I'm going to tell you something, if you can keep it confidential.
I can.
Kate's sister is here with a British newspaper reporter. I met them last night, and they let it slip they think she's still here, alive. They think some local has her locked up somewhere. In fact, I got a glimpse of a photo they took that could be her, but they wouldn't let me get a good look at it. Sheridan's eyes got large.
You've got to be kidding me.
Nope.
If they think they've found her, why didn't they go get her out?
I was wondering the same thing, he said. There's more to this, but the journalist wouldn't let Sophie talk to me about it.
Does Sophie have red hair?
Yep. Sheridan shook her head.
I haven't seen them myself, but I heard they harassed our GM the other day, and Lance told me he helped a maintenance guy pull them out of a snowdrift after they'd left. They'd trespassed here on the ranch, and they got stuck because they didn't know how to drive in the snow.
That's them.
Do you know what they drive? She asked.
No, he said, thinking that he should know that. Why?
I saw a strange vehicle a couple of days ago, and I called it in to Lance. There were two people in the truck, and I had the feeling they were watching me from across the river. Could that be them?
Describe the vehicle.
It was a four-wheel drive pickup with a camper shell, she said. It was light-colored, maybe off-white or gray. I didn't get a very good look at it, and I couldn't see any license plates from that distance.
It sounds like the truck I saw this morning, he said.
Before he could continue, his phone went off in his pocket, and he pulled it out and looked at the screen.
Nate, he said to Sheridan, I need to take this.
Nate's here? She asked.
He's helping me, Joe said. I think. Sheridan watched her dad take the call. She felt both thrilled and disconcerted.
The man who used to cook her breakfast and take her out on ride-alongs was speaking to her as if she were an equal. She wasn't used to it, and she wasn't sure what she felt about it.
She thought she liked it, that it meant she'd matured, and he recognized that.
But at the same time, she had a feeling that something special was now lost between them. But maybe in a good way.
And she felt guilty not telling him more about how she felt about Lance, that the head wrangler was her sun, her moon, her stars, that he'd carefully cleared all of his things out of her apartment before her dad had arrived, that he'd gone to his cabin in the snow for the weekend because he had nowhere else to go.
"What do you mean you shot him and then hit him with a fish?" her dad said, his voice rising.
Sheridan was confused at first, but then again, it was Nate he was talking with. If there was anybody capable of shooting a man and then hitting him with a fish, it was Nate Romanowski, her master falconer. Even if she couldn't imagine the scenario, where did Nate get a fish in the middle of the winter with the rivers and lakes frozen?
What if he calls the sheriff? Her dad asked Nate.
Joe could feel Sheridan's eyes on him as Nate said,
"Come on, Joe. What's he gonna say? Is he going to tell them a guy came out and shot him inside his meth lab? He's not going to involve law enforcement in this at all."
"I'm law enforcement." Nate didn't respond. "What if he bleeds out?" Joe asked.
"Then there'll be one less scumbag in the world."
"Nate?"
Nate said, "I figure he'll end up in the hospital using some lame excuse for the gunshot wound. His dad won't let him die."
"Good.
Hey, do you want a fish for dinner? I bet you could ask them to cook it up for you at the Wolf."
Joe took a deep breath and expelled it slowly while he tried to stay calm. "Tell me exactly what he said when you were torturing him." Nate snorted at the word torture. Then,
"He said he was in a bar texting someone to make a drug deal and overheard these two old guys talking about Kate, that she was still alive and in the area. Dubner said he listened but kept his head down, and he's not even sure what the two guys looked like. He was high on his own product at the time."
"Which bar?"
"The Rustic."
"That's it?" Joe asked. "Did he tell you when it was?"
"He said he couldn't remember, but he thought it was in October or November, but he wasn't sure."
"So, 2 or 3 months ago," Joe said. "This makes the second time it's come up that she might still be alive."
"What about the fish?"
Nate asked.
"You know I don't kill things for sport."
"Meet me here," Joe said. "I'm at the Silver Creek Ranch with Sheridan."
"I thought I was supposed to interview Sophie and the fop."
"I can't afford any more casualties," Joe said, and punched off on Nate in mid-chuckle. "So where did he get a fish in the middle of the winter?" Sheridan asked Joe.
"From a fish hatchery," he said.
Sheridan grinned at the absurdity of it, and Joe had to agree. The phone was still in his hand when a text message appeared from Mary Beth. It read, "Check out this link and call me." "Your mom found something," he said to Sheridan as he stabbed the hyperlink on his screen with his index finger and waited for it to load. What appeared was the online homepage of the Daily Dispatch. Under a headline that read, "Is this Kate?" was the grainy photo Joe had glimpsed the night before on Sophie's phone.
"Oh, no," he said.
"What is it?" Sheridan asked.
"The fop strikes," Joe said.
He expanded the photo to fill the screen. It was presumably taken from a long distance, and it was more out of focus than he recalled. But there it was. The back of a seated person with blonde hair, seen through a window, the figure of a man looming in shadows in the background, as if approaching her. Joe noted snow on the outside windowsill and weathered log walls that he hadn't noticed previously. The byline of the story was credited to Billy Bloodworth. "Is this a photo of missing Kate Shelford Longdon being held captive by a mountain man in the wilds of Wyoming, an area where primitive, gun-toting, Trump-voting individualists still occupy the mountains? The single photo appears to show Cowgirl Kate, the British PR MD, long thought dead, being menaced by an unknown male while she cowers near a window. The photo was taken within the last week and obtained exclusively from a source by the Daily Dispatch. The exact location of this den of depravity is unknown at press time. Kate's fetching sister, Sophie Shelford Longdon, who is on location in Wyoming to search for her sibling as part of a dispatch investigative team, said she was cautiously optimistic that her sibling was still alive and being held against her will. "This is a remarkable development," she said. "I can say within 80% certainty that the woman in the photo is my sister Kate. It's like my prayers have been answered." Prior to the revelation of this photo, U.S. law enforcement authorities have been stymied thus far into the investigation into cowgirl Kate's disappearance, leading many to wonder if a thorough effort had even been made. "What a weasel," Joe said to Sheridan. "He's a lot more interested in headlines than actually finding her." "Can I read it?" she asked eagerly. He sent her the link and speed-dialed Mary Beth. "That story just appeared on their website," Mary Beth said. "They're 7 hours ahead of us, so it's midnight there, and likely very few Brits have seen it yet. But when it comes out in print tomorrow morning over there, you'll have a full-blown tabloid scandal on your hands." Joe grunted. "I wouldn't be surprised if more reporters start showing up now," she said. "They're really competitive over there."
"That's all we need,"
she said what he was thinking. "I can't imagine Governor Allen and Hanlon are going to like this news."
"Nope," Joe sighed.
"Maybe you should brief them before they find out on their own."
"If I get a minute, I will."
He filled her in on developments since he'd last talked with her. "A fish?" Mary Beth asked. "He beat a man with a fish?"
"Yep."
"What's with this Billy Bloodworth guy?" she asked. Joe said, "It's obvious he has an agenda of his own. He's been uncooperative with us, to say the least. I can't tell if Sophie trusts him or whether she was duped to get involved in his trip over here." "So there is no investigative team?" "He's the investigative team. I wish I knew where that photo came from." "Maybe Nate can visit him and bring his fish," she said. Joe didn't laugh. "I was kidding," she said. Mary Beth changed the subject by telling Joe what she'd learned about Kate's ex-husband, Richard Cheatham. Although he'd given a few pithy quotes on her disappearance when it happened, she said, he'd stayed out of the story ever since. Apparently he'd moved from London to an estate in the countryside in the Midlands and had recently remarried. Mary Beth had found records of their divorce settlement and a few small news stories about the proceedings, enough information to indicate that he'd gotten a pretty good deal. He still owned nearly half the shares in Athena, and if Kate continued to shepherd the company well, he received a steady income. Mary Beth confirmed that the PR company had been profitable the last 2 years. Unless Richard had some other reason to harbor a murderous resentment toward Kate, she said, it seemed he had no transparent motive to hatch a scheme to go after his ex-wife while she was on vacation in another country. Mary Beth's conclusion was that Richard's name should be moved to the very bottom of the suspect list, but not yet crossed off. He realized Sheridan was talking to him as well, and he looked up. "Tell Mom hello," she said. "Sheridan says hello. Tell her to call me tonight and we can catch up." He said he would. "It sounds like you're going to be busy," she said. "At least it's not snowing there today and you can get around easier." He agreed, but said, "How do you know it's not snowing?" "I checked the webcam," she said.
"What webcam?"
"There's a single webcam for Saratoga. It's on the homepage of the radio station there." Joe hadn't noticed a single closed-circuit camera around town when he arrived, which wasn't unusual for a community that small. He apparently missed the webcam unit. "What can you see?" he asked. "The main street," she said, "including the porch of the Hotel Wolf." Can you see the rustic bar? It's at the end of the block. After a few seconds, she said, Yes, I can see it. For a minute, he didn't speak. Joe?
I'm here.
What's going on?
I'm thinking.
I hope my phone battery holds up long enough, she joked. Can I ask you to do something else? He said, oblivious.
Of course.
Find out who owns the radio station and see if they have a way of accessing their computer archives for the last couple of months. I don't know if a webcam even has archives, but please check. We need to know whether or not we can find out who entered and exited the rustic bar in October, November, maybe even December. I know it's a long shot, but maybe it'll help. Can you give me a specific date?
I wish I could.
Then he went silent again. Joe? I think I know how we might be able to determine the date, he said. But if you could make contact with the owner or his tech guy in the meanwhile, I'd appreciate it. She agreed and said she'd call him back when she learned more. Can this be true? Sheridan asked Joe after reading the dispatch article.
I doubt it, Joe said.
I'm not so sure, Sheridan mused.
Do you recognize the cabin?
Joe asked. Sheridan's eyes flared. If you're asking me if it's Lance's cabin, it's not.
Sorry, he said.
There were footfalls on the stairway outside Sheridan's apartment, followed by a heavy rap on the door.
Nate, Joe told Sheridan.
Her eyes got large, and she rushed to the door to open it.
There she is, Nate said to Sheridan. She's a cowgirl.
I'm a falconer first, she said. I'm playing cowgirl until my master falconer finally decides to show up again. He smiled at her.
Every time I see you, you're in the middle of some kind of trouble, and we never get around to falconry.
Sheridan gestured toward Joe. Blame him this time. Nate turned serious. He said,
Falconry, as you know, is Zen. You can't rush it. We need some uninterrupted time to resume your apprenticeship.
Did you bring any of your birds with you? She asked.
Not this time.
While Sheridan and Nate talked falconry, Joe called the Memorial Hospital of Carbon County. The receptionist made it very clear that she couldn't give out any information on patients other than to confirm they'd been admitted. His name is Joshua Tubner, Joe said, spelling the last name. The receptionist confirmed that he was there, alive. Joe thanked her and cleared his throat to get Nate and Sheridan's attention. Nate was telling her about recently seeing the gerfalcon he'd hunted with 2 years before in the Red Desert. I hate to break this up, but we're going to Rawlins to visit Joshua Tubner in the hospital, Joe said. I need to look at his cell phone if I can.
I'll bring my fish,
Nate said. It made Sheridan cover her mouth so she wouldn't laugh out loud. Leave the fish here, Joe said. While we're in town, I'll brief Sheriff Neal on where we're at. I'd like to tag along, Sheridan said to Joe. I'm pretty much done for the day. He started to object, but didn't have a good reason to do so. Maybe you can keep an eye on him, Joe said, indicating Nate. I'll be happy to do that, she said with a full wattage smile. Nate and Sheridan went down the stairs, and Joe was a beat behind them when his phone lit up in his hand. He glanced at the screen. Hanlon. He considered letting the call go to voicemail, but he punched it up instead. What the fuck is going on over there? Hanlon asked. Joe could hear traffic sounds in the background and assumed Hanlon was racing from place to place in Cheyenne in his SUV. Before Joe could respond, Hanlon said, "I just got off the phone with Governor Allen. The British consulate called him and said there's a photo of Kate blah blah on the front page of an English rag. They said there's evidence that she's being held against her will in our state right now, right under your nose." Joe said, "It's unconfirmed. I was going to tell you about..." Hanlon cut him off. "When? This is not the way things should work. I shouldn't be calling you to find out what the hell you're doing. You're supposed to keep me up to speed on your investigation. I never again want to learn about something from the governor or from a British tabloid. So are you going to confirm that photo and find her?" "I'm on it," Joe said, tight-lipped. He knew he should have briefed Hanlon earlier, as Marybeth had suggested. "Governor Allen isn't happy about this development, Pickett."
"Neither am I."
"But there's a difference," Hanlon said with full calm. "He's the governor, and you're a nobody."
"I'm well aware of that."
"We've called a press conference for tomorrow, where the governor will announce that Kate has been rescued. I'm going to ask the British consulate to send a representative. It'll be a big deal, and it'll be great for us to get this stupid issue off our plate, and we'll finally have a win."
Joe sat up straight. "I'd really advise you not to do that until we know for sure we've got her."
"I tell you what, you do your job, and I'll do mine."
Hanlon terminated the call before Joe could ask about the keys to Pollock's house.
"Trouble?"
Nate asked outside as Joe strode around him toward his pickup.
"Politics," Joe said.
"This is the life you've chosen."
"Not really," he said, while climbing behind the wheel and turning the key in the ignition.
They drove north on YO 130 toward Walcott Junction, with Nate in the passenger seat and Sheridan crammed into the back amidst discarded winter clothing and other gear. Shadows were starting to nose west on the snow from exposed sage and buckbrush in the late afternoon sun. Joe told Nate about Billy Bloodworth's scoop, and Sheridan let him read it on her phone.
"That photo could be from anywhere,"
Nate said about the shot.
"It could have been taken 2 years ago, or it could be staged."
"Maybe," Joe said. "Or maybe she's still here," Sheridan said from the back seat. "Did you know William Shakespeare was a falconer?" Sheridan asked Nate.
"Yes, I did,"
he said.
"It's true," Sheridan said to Joe, who was obviously unaware of the fact.
"He used falconry terms in his plays that have become part of the English language. Only people don't know where they came from. Fed up is from when a bird has eaten too much of his kill and doesn't want to hunt or do anything for a while," she said. "And under my thumb and wrapped around his little finger are from holding a falcon tight to your fist by its jesses so it can't fly. Those terms were in Shakespeare's plays, and until then, they weren't common usage." She said, "Haggard is a falcon that's difficult to fly, and hoodwinked is from putting the leather hood on the bird so it can't see to fly away."
"Interesting," Joe said. He meant it.
Nate recited,
"My falcon now is sharp and passing empty, and till she stoop, she must not be full-gorged, for then she never looks upon her lure. Another way I have to man my haggard, to make her come and know her keeper's call."
"That's from The Taming of the Shrew," Sheridan told Joe.
Joe looked skeptically at his friend and then at his daughter. He'd never heard Nate recite poetry before, and was unaware that Sheridan had that much familiarity with Shakespeare.
"You two make me feel stupid," he confessed.
Nate shrugged.
"We're falconers," he said.
Sheridan giggled. 2 miles south of Walcott Junction and I-80, Joe speed-dialed Sheriff Neal's private number. The sheriff answered immediately. Sheriff, Joe Pickett. I'm on my way to Rawlins right now to brief you on some new developments.
Where are you now?
I can see the interstate.
Well, hold tight, Neal said. In fact, pull over and wait for us.
Why?
We've got a man in custody on a DUI rap who claims he took the picture of Kate and sold it to the English reporter 2 days ago. He's agreed to show us where the cabin is, so we're headed your way. We're about 10 minutes out.
Joe pulled over.
Here we go, he said.
What's going on? Sheridan asked.
Break in the case.
His heart raced. Joshua Tubner's phone records would have to wait, and might not even be necessary.
Chapter 18. 3 Carbon County Sheriff's SUVs with lights flashing took the Walcott Junction exit, followed by a 3/4-ton pickup hauling a trailer topped with 6 snowmobiles. Joe powered his window down as the caravan approached and slowed to a stop on the highway. Neal was in the lead, and he climbed out of his Chevrolet Tahoe and lumbered over to the pickup. Neal was heavyset and stoop-shouldered. He had a thick mustache threaded with gray and large brown cop eyes that took in everything he looked at. As he neared Joe's truck, he could see Neal assessing Nate and then Sheridan. The sheriff zipped up his heavy parka against the cold as he approached Joe's window.
"Why can't this stuff ever happen on a nice summer day?" he said.
"I see you brought snowmobiles," Joe said, nodding toward the 3/4-ton.
"I called a snowmobile outfitter I know and rented his whole fleet," Neal said with a shake of his head. "That'll do some damage on my budget."
"So where are we going?"
"All the way up the Snowy Range Road until it ends," Neal said.
Joe knew that the Snowy Range receives so much snow every winter that the highway department didn't bother to plow it until spring. And even then they had to use rotary snow plows to cut through the 10 to 12 feet of accumulation that blew off the roadway into huge plumes. He'd noted that the snow got so deep that highway workers attached 15-foot lengths of wood to the steel mile markers so the plow drivers could discern where the road was located.
"Who is your informant?" Joe asked. He could see the silhouette of a head in Neal's back seat. The man had a round face the shape of a pie tin and a scraggly beard. "Name's Eli Jarrett. We know him."
He said it in a way that meant he's familiar to law enforcement and not in a good way.
"Eli used to work in the mine in Hanna before it went bust. Picked him up a few times for DUI. Likes meth, too."
Joe heard Nate grunt with recognition from the passenger seat. Neal thumbed over his shoulder toward Jarrett.
"He collects sheds in the mountains and sells them to dealers. He said he knows of a couple of open meadows up there where the wind blows them clean in the winter. He took a snowmobile and sled up there last weekend to try and get a jump on his competition."
Joe knew that sheds were elk antlers that naturally detached and dropped to the ground each winter from bull elk. The price for them from Asian pharmaceutical representatives, artists, and furniture makers had climbed to over $15 per pound, meaning that a massive set could go for over $800. It was tough work, but it could be lucrative. There was a big run on sheds in the late spring and early summer when the snow melted to reveal them where they'd dropped. Shed wars were so named because collectors sometimes got into disputes with others over territory, and there were very few rules or regulations about gathering them. There were shed wars in other Wyoming mountain ranges, including Joe's Bighorns.
That's where Eli bumbled onto a cabin, Neil said. He said he was surprised it was occupied, because the road to it had snowed in.
Do you know who the cabin belongs to?
Joe asked.
Trapper by the name of Les McKnight, Neil said. He's a mysterious old coot who sometimes works for the Fish and Wildlife Service, but mainly he works for himself, gets badgers, beavers, coyotes.
I've seen him, Sheridan said urgently from the back seat. He put some traps by the river last summer at the ranch.
Silver Creek Ranch? Neil asked her.
That's where I work, she said.
Well, there you go, Neil said to Joe. That puts McKnight on the ranch where Kate disappeared.
Suddenly, Billy Bloodworth and Sophie's theory sounded more plausible, Joe thought.
Eli had his phone with him, and he took some pictures of McKnight's cabin, Neil said. It wasn't until he got home and looked at them that he noticed the blonde in the window. He ran into that English feller in the bar and sold him the photos for a couple of $100 apiece. He didn't know what the reporter was going to do with them or how fast they'd show up on the Internet.
The sheriff used the word Internet as if it was some strange new trend in technology, Joe noted.
Neil sighed. That's his story, anyway. The photos are still on his phone, so he's not lying about that part.
The sheriff squinted against the icy wind and looked at the mountains to the east.
We better get going if we